Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we begin a two-week conversation with John Fulcher, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Peter Searles. Since the publication of his first collection in 1983, Light Pressure, which Les Murray published as part of the Angus and Robertson poetry series, Canberra-based poet John Fulcher has gone on to issue many other volumes and to be a regular contributor to prominent journals. After several more collections, a 2010 Australia Council residency took John Fulcher to Paris. In 2012, Pitt Street Poetry published his The Sunset Assumption, which drew from his time in France. Pitt Street then published his 101 Poems, 2015, A Casual Penance, 2017, and Dancing with Stephen Hawking, 2021. His next book, The Night Stare, is due out in April 2025. Robert Gray aptly wrote of John Fulcher's poetry, "His theme is a skeptical faith, complemented by the uneasiness of domesticity. It is the heroism of the modern, isolated individual. The man or woman who remembers to put out the garbage bin for 50 years, who stands on the nature strip and looks at the unbelievably violent furnaces that are the stars, and asks what place there is for the transcendent impulses that arise within us." My co-host, Kimberly K. Williams, began by asking John Fulcher about his most recent book, Dancing with Stephen Hawking.
I wondered how you see this book in shape of all the years you've been writing.
Look, you always think this about the last thing you've written, but I tend to think it's my best book. I found in my writing career, the trajectory of it, that in the first part of this century, I kind of ran out of steam. I thought I was done. I'd published selected poems and just felt tired. And then on the off chance, I applied for the studio in Paris, the Kiesing studio, and I could not believe it when I actually got it. And what it meant was 6 months in Paris. Now, that completely rejuvenated my writing. I think it was the very fact of getting time. I'd had time because I'd had fellowships and things in the past, but it was being in a completely alien environment where even ordering a cup of coffee was a traumatic experience. Also, you know, it reoriented the way I looked at my work. And I think the book that came out of that was called The Sunset Assumption. And that's my second favourite book. And I think those two are my best books overall. I was amazed also when Dancing with Stephen Hawking was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards. And Jeff Lehman, who was one of the judges there, who'd never had any particular interest in my work, I don't think, told me he thought that I was a late bloomer. And I think that might be true. You can never tell with your own work. You've just got to go what other people think. But it feels that way to me.
Well, your 101 poems came out in 2016.
Yep, yep.
That's also Pitt Street.
Yes, it is.
I think to have a book like this, that means that you have to have a pretty substantial...
Yeah.
To have 101 poems that you can draw from many collections.
Yeah.
Did that help you see your poems
it
in a
did.
Certain way?
It did. I mean, one thing I've always tried to do, after I published my first book, which was called Light Pressure, in 1983, I think it was Peter Goldsworthy who said to me, when you publish your next book, don't try to get better, try to get worse. And what he meant was, you know what you do well now, don't just keep doing it. He meant, you know, sort of what you should be doing as a poet is extending yourself, risking failure all the time. And I think I've tried to do that. I look at my books and they seem different to me.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Do you know who was that way? It was Louise Gluck.
Really?
She was very much like
right.
that. She would actually set an intention for how she might stretch herself even. And I saw an interview with her and she was saying she was going to do more with punctuation for her next
right.
book. That next book turned out to be The Wild Iris, and then she
right.
won the Pulitzer Prize for it.
Yes.
So I think this is probably, you're onto something.
Yeah, I think so. and you will fail sometimes, you know, sort of. But the aim of writing poetry is to explore yourself and the world in the intersection between yourself and the world. It's not to write great poetry. The reason why trying to do it as well as you can is because it makes it a sharper tool as such. And I think some of the poets that influenced me when I was very young, when I was first writing, I still love, but I look at their work and it hasn't changed much. And so the work I love is the work I loved back then. Whereas I hope people can look at my work and go, what's he going to do this time? You know, we'll see how it goes. I've got another book coming out in April, I think.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, it's called The Night Stare, S-T-A-I-R. And my publishers tell me that they think this is my best, but I don't know about that. Mm. I still think that Stephen Hawking has a particular place in my heart.
Will that also be Pitt Street?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That was the other thing. When I got back from Paris, Pitt Street didn't exist. And the publisher of Pitt Street, who I'd known for quite some time, John Knight, approached me and said, have you got a book come out of that? And I said, yes, I don't know what to do with it. And he said, can we publish it? And that was the first book that Pitt Street published. The good thing about that is that since then, as you know, Pitt Street is one of the premier, you know, the top poetry publishers in the country. And John said to me once, you showed faith in us when we were nothing. You've got a publisher for as long as this press continues. Oh. And that is extraordinarily liberating, because that means you can say, I can experiment now. I can take risks.
Really even adds another layer to that prior comment. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know any other poet who really has that.
There's not a lot of them now, you know.
Nowadays.
And, you know, the way poetry press has come in this country now as they rise and fall. Pitt Street's been going for, I think, about 13, 14 years. It won't go on forever.
Yeah.
But I'll be kind of dottery by the time it finishes. It's been good for me, though, because it's actually, again, been one of those things that's helped me hone what I do, I think, really strongly.
Love that. Let's have a few poems.
Sure.
John Fulcher read first The Hawkesbury Morning, which was the first poem in his first published volume, Light Pressure, in 1983, and also one of his collected 101 poems, which Pitt Street published in 2016. That was the first in Pitt Street's series of such retrospectives that, the press says, bring together the best work of Australia's leading poets as collectible, definitive editions. Pitt Street described John Fulcher's poetry as the paradigm of what it seeks to publish: thoughtful, superbly crafted, witty, personal, and profound.
It's kind of like a thin sonnet. It's two lines short, but it's got the same kind of structure that a sonnet would have, yeah. I think. I must admit, I look back on my early books and half the poems I don't like at all, but some of them you look at and go, yeah, I really like that still, and this is one. Hawkesbury Morning. Waking, listening to black cockatoos snapping nuts in the casuarina. They are penciled on the sky, and when their wings lift, they're red like first flames. Fire in long grass, bodies dark as charred trees. The sky is pegged between branches, a faded blue cloth, still damp. Downstairs, the children cast sounds, trailing like fishing line through the rooms, reeling us in as if life were teeming always in their wake. It's this confidence that I lack. I hear you speak to them quietly, and cups and plates on the kitchen table.
I didn't even count the lines. I think I just assumed that's a sonnet because there's such a clear turn.
There is. Yeah, there's. As soon as they hit the children, that becomes a turning point in the poem.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's such a wide poem. The sky pegged between branches. I mean, what a gorgeous image that is. And it's just so wide. And it comes down so quickly. And that's why I love a sonnet. That's what it can do, right? It can go so fast.
Yeah. And the thing about this one, too, I think, is that the sky is pegged between branches. It's so wide, but it's a very domestic image. Mm. So it's sort of like when you get to the domestic thing, it doesn't come out of nowhere.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
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 That's right. Yeah. A lot of movement in that poem.
Let's hear that poem again.
Hawkesbury Morning. Waking, listening to black cockatoos snapping nuts in the casuarina. They are penciled on the sky, and when their wings lift, they're red like first flames. Fire in long grass, bodies dark as charred trees. The sky is pegged between branches, a faded blue cloth, still damp. Downstairs, the children cast sounds, trailing like fishing line through the rooms, reeling us in as if life were teeming always in their wake. It's this confidence that I lack. I hear you speak to them quietly, and cups and plates on the kitchen table.
Next, John Fulcher read the title poem of his volume Dancing with Stephen Hawking from 2021.
This poem, it's based on an experience that my fellow Canberra poet, Melinda Smith, had. She said when she was, I've changed it, but I was talking to her once and she told me that when she was in England, which was during the grunge days, not the punk days, as the poem says, she went to a party and she fell over on the way and she looked a mess. And then this woman came up to her and said, he wants to dance with you. And there was Stephen Hawking in his chair. And so she went and danced with him while he was in his chair. Then they smiled at each other and walked away. And I said to her, Melinda, that would make a great poem. And she said, I've wanted to write it, but every time I do, it looks like I'm big noting myself. And I said, well, would you mind if I had a go? And she said, it's all yours. And this is the poem. Dancing with Stephen Hawking. I was living in England. Punk days they were. On my way to the party, I fell and scraped skin from my knees, tore my stockings. No matter, they were punk days, and I looked the part, blackroot blonde, makeup slurring my face. And there she was. He wants to dance with you. And there he was, seeping into his chair, mind in the machine. From a distance, I'd thought him all thought, the body's ruined, savaging desire. But something simmered there. He rolled across the wooden floor like a ship leaving harbour, adrift on a wide sea. I did my best punk moves, spasmodic thrusts and jumps, while he swayed left then right in his choreography of wheels. I tried not to stare. We moved until the music slammed into silence, left everyone talking too loud for a moment, like the noise of insects in the dark. I don't recall talking at all, only the time given. Walking to the station, I stopped, looked up to a moonless sky, wondering whether that cloud was a cloud or a galaxy. And I thought of the dance of asteroids, the merciless pull of black holes, red giants and white dwarfs, breathless nebulae. I thought of the atoms in my eye spinning and spinning, and the torrent of light surging through me, soaking me to the bone as I stood looking up with my bloodied knees.
Boy, that's a poem. When you hear it out loud and you realize how much you can savor the sounds.
Oh, thank you.
You really can.
Great.
And I know Melinda.
Yeah.
And it's just really, so I can imagine her part in this.
Yeah.
Let's hear that one again too. And then The Linguist in Love from the same volume, Dancing with Stephen Hawking.
Dancing with Stephen Hawking. I was living in England. Punk days they were. On my way to the party, I fell and scraped skin from my knees, tore my stockings. No matter, they were punk days, and I looked the part, blackroot blonde, makeup slurring my face. And there she was. He wants to dance with you. And there he was, seeping into his chair, mind in the machine. From a distance, I'd thought him all thought. The body's ruined, savaging desire. But something simmered there. He rolled across the wooden floor like a ship leaving harbour, adrift on a wide sea. I did my best punk moves, spasmodic thrusts and jumps, while he swayed left then right in his choreography of wheels. I tried not to stare. We moved until the music slammed into silence, left everyone talking too loud for a moment, like the noise of insects in the dark. I don't recall talking at all, only the time given. Walking to the station, I stopped, looked up to a moonless sky, wondering whether that cloud was a cloud or a galaxy. And I thought of the dance of asteroids, the merciless pull of black holes, red giants and white dwarfs, breathless nebulae. I thought of the atoms in my eye spinning and spinning, and the torrent of light surging through me, soaking me to the bone as I stood looking up with my bloodied knees. This one depends on punctuation, so I'm going to have to enunciate punctuation. It's another dramatic monologue. I suppose that's the difference between my early poems and my later ones, but we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
The Linguist in Love. Notwithstanding advertisements, email, and popular novelists, I am resisting fads in however. Maintaining however never joins but creates things anew, therefore stands in goalpost uppercase behind a sure point of conclusion thus. You have taken my heart, full stop, capital, however, comma, she has taken yours. Reluctantly, I concede the semicolon, for nothing is discreet. All things defer to others, as in, I love you, comma, still, semicolon, however, comma, she has taken your heart. These days, though, it seems that anything will do, however, clamps sentence with sentence in parody of comma, and we say, oh, how I love you still, comma, however, she has taken your heart, and I don't know what I will do. Here, however, spells out how little we care about getting things right, how little we care about punctuating truth.
I don't know if it's the teacher in me that just, I just adore this on so many levels. I mean, this idea that punctuation is a poet's tool and we must tend to use them accordingly. And it is about getting things right with poetry, isn't it? Like
it
you
is.
Said,
yep.
You mostly do it to explore.
Yep.
But yep. At the same time, you want to get it right so that
Absolutely.
It's sharp. Is that
That's
the word
right.
you
That's
use?
That's exactly
yeah.
right. Yeah.
yeah.
I think it was Seamus Heaney who first compared a poem to a spade. I'll dig with it. His pen he was talking about. And as I say, I think you've got to get it sharp. You know a sloppy bad poem when you read it because it doesn't tell the author anything that they don't know already. But that's the other thing about a good poem. I think it you never know what you're doing when you're writing a poem. I don't know how many poems I've thought, oh, I'm going to say this, and it's gone somewhere entirely different. You don't control the poem. It controls you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. Oh, you're facilitating its lead.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a wayward child.
I love that. You were going to say something about the dramatic monologues?
Yeah, I think one of the things that as I've got older, I've written more and more dramatic monologues as a way of detaching yourself from experience. I think two things I wanted to say about that. I think the first one is that you need to be detached from your experience. You need to actually stand back and with a cold eye examine it. And I think the one thing that I'd also say about that too is I really think that above everything, poetry is not ideological because you don't go in with a certain, your most deep convictions are at the mercy of a poem. And, you know, it's why I sometimes find that I have trouble with, say, political poetry because I think it always knows what it wants to say before it starts. And I think, well, why bother writing the poem if you know what you want to say? Because the poem, like when I was a teacher, you talked about being a teacher. I used to say to kids, this is obvious hyperbole, but I used to say to kids, there are two types of poems, one where the poet knows exactly what they want to say and they write the poem to express it, and one where the poet has no idea what they want to say and they write the poem to find out what it is. The first type is called bad poetry and the second type is called the real thing. And I think too often I think it's a disease, and I think it's around in poetry at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of flag waving in poetry at the moment, and I think it undermines the value of poetry. That's just me, anyway.
Yeah, I hear completely what you're saying. I'm wondering then, what gets you into a poem? Is it language? Is it sound? Like, if you're not entering it through the idea, which I agree, it's very dangerous to do that.
Yeah.
Because you do risk it being.
Yep.
Not being at all a surprise, yep. Which is the joy in the poem.
Yeah, if the poet doesn't surprise the poet, it's not going to surprise anyone else.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. What I love about the poem that you just read about the punctuation is that each line is a surprise. How is he going to reconfigure this and show me a different meaning?
Yeah.
And I mean, and that is why the little stuff matters, especially in poetry, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's compressed.
Yeah.
So you have to get it right to have.
That's right. You use as few words as you possibly can. Yeah.
And yet it can have a massive impact, which is
it
really
resonates.
Cool.
Yeah. 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 So what gets me into a poem? I think to me it's always something about sensation. It's often visual. I'll see something. But I think what it is that gets you in, to me it's a confluence of something you see and something that triggers something in the subconscious. And so it's those two things hitting against each other. And that's where the friction in a poem comes from. That's where the tension and excitement comes from. As I said before, I think what poetry is essentially is it deals with that intersection between the self and the world. And that intersection is often not rational or not even conscious. And it's exploring that intersection, I think. Yeah.
I think that's beautifully said.
Oh,
like,
thank you.
I will ponder that. It's interesting to me that you're talking, you're saying the word seeing. You've got a poem in the Dancing with Stephen Hawking book for your son.
Yeah.
And I wrote in my notes that this really is a poem about seeing.
Yeah, it is. An atheist for God, for my son Dylan. My eyes are not the same eyes. I see through frosted glass. Only long memories have an edge. Years ago, after my son turned 20, I took him to an optometrist. He had always thought the world vague, and we were always distracted. When he slipped on his first pair of spectacles, the world's spectacle slipped from a fog on the road to Damascus. I remember the way he stared at his hands, the delicate leaves, distance. I remember a parent's guilt. This morning, wandering glassless in the library, I glimpse a book high up, An Atheist for God. Taking it down, I see I've been wrong again. I hold the book, A Thirst for God, lightly in my hand. When I look at that poem, I think it is about seeing. It's also about, for me, something about faith. You know how people say, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm a spiritual person. And I have no idea what they mean. They usually mean I like to walk on the beach, sort of at sunset and soft furry animals. I feel a bit differently. I feel like I'm not a spiritual person, but I am a religious one. I've always felt this connection to being in a church. I don't understand it, but it's crucial to me. But I think, as I said before, the role of the poem is to interrogate brutally your most deeply held convictions, and that certainly applies for me. So I'm torn between being an atheist for God and having a thirst for God, if that makes any sense. And I think that's the poem is about conviction as well. It's also, I remember when I took my son to the optometrist and we had never picked it up. And I had to get a pair of glasses, reading glasses. And he said, oh, can I come too? And, you know, he got his and we had to pick them up the next week. And I'll never forget, I put mine on and I thought, oh, that's better. He put his on and he went, oh, wow. He'd always thought things in the distance were blurred. That's the way they were. He could not believe it. And all I could feel was, what sort of shit parent are you?
Right. That line, it tends to something that needs tending to. Because you're thinking, as a parent, I'm thinking, how did he not know? Right. We all do this as parents. We have our blind spots, if you will.
Oh, that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah, I listen to people talk about their religious beliefs or their spiritual beliefs and or practices. And a lot of it has to do with certainty. And, and seeing and certainty kind of go hand in hand. For me, I don't have to see anything to have a certainty.
Yeah, see, I'm just the opposite. I think it should be about uncertainty. I mean, the older I get, the more I realize, the less I know. I know that's a common sentiment, but it's common for a reason.
The older you get, the more profound that knowing that you don't know.
Yeah.
Becomes.
It's that line from Paul Weller, you know, who used to be in the Jam, which was, the more I see, the less I know. The more I know, the less I understand. I'm the changing man.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true.
Yeah.
Poetry on the Radio producer Peter Monahan asked,
you talk about seeing, you talk about that sense of being in a church, so there's something to behold.
Yeah.
And you see the art of poetry as being one where you enter without preconception. I've noticed in quite a few of your poems that you register what you see almost as if it's happening despite you, without you, and then you grapple with that.
Yeah.
That all is of a piece, it seems to me.
Yeah. I that's well put, Peter. I'd never actually thought about it, but just registering what you see. And then it stands in front of you with its arms folded, saying, well, you know, I think that that is something that's very important.
It's almost like it's saying, well, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got to use language.
Yeah, that's right.
And your tools
to
figure it out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why, you know, particularly when you're dealing with religious poetry, it can't be ideological. You are at, betraying the purpose of poetry. I've always held some kind of Christian belief. You know, it's changed and varied as I've gone on, and now it's much more uncertain than it's ever been. You know, but I remember when I had my first book published, I got a very nice review by a strongly Christian poet, who's also very good. I won't name him. And he said, look, this book is really great. And he went through all the virtues of it. And he said, the only thing that worries me is it could have been written by an atheist. And there is no poem here that identifies him as a Christian. And I remember when I read it, I thought, this man does not understand what poetry is for at all. And the older I've got, the more I've felt that. That you, if you can't, you know, I actually have in my life done workshops for Christians wanting to write poets, and I kind of shocked them all by saying, you know, when you sit down to write a poem, you are a poet first and a Christian second. You park your beliefs and you let the poem dig into them, and if you don't like what you find, tough luck. You live with it. I think that's really important. I think it's not just intellectual honesty, it's poetic honesty as well.
Right.
And religious honesty too.
Just authenticity in all of its forms.
Yeah.
And I think there is certainly an established relationship between poetry and religious expression, right? Yeah. I mean, even the Bible has
full of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Plus, like, I'm thinking Sufism, I'm thinking of like the, you know, Rumi. Hafiz. And but at the same time, it's almost like in those places, a door is opened.
Yep.
Right, and the reader does or doesn't go through. You're not shoving anyone through the door because they won't be shoved.
You invite them in, but you certainly don't do any further than that.
Exactly,
because you don't even know what you're inviting them into.
Right,
most of the time, I think.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, we've been speaking with John Fulcher, and we'll continue the conversation next week. By the way, John Fulcher is one of two featured poets at Jeff's Poetry at Smith's Alternative in Civic on March 3rd. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic, on Monday, February 24, that poetry thing is a big open mic. On March 3, Jeff's Poetry at Smith's features Peter Rose and John Fulcher. Poetry on the Radio is produced on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM in Canberra. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.